Thanks for listening to the Best of Outkick the Coverage podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the Coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis on Fox Sports Radio.
Welcome back in, Friday edition, Outkick the Coverage. I hope all of you are having a fantastic day wherever you may be across this great country or this great land. We were just talking about the MLB and the NBA and the challenges they have. And one of the most iconic NBA players of his generation is Vince Carter. And Vince Carter has decided, after a monumental career in the league, to hang up the sneakers and move on. I think he'll probably have a lot of different really cool options in the media, because I've seen this guy and the way he's already started to kind of dip his toe into the media. He's 43 years old now, and he had a 22-year NBA career, and this is just incredible. He hadn't really let us know what he was going to do with the NBA season continuing, but he said that he's basically done. Several different stats here. He's 19th all-time in scoring. League's Rookie of the Year. Over his career, he averaged 16.7 points per game, played for eight different teams. I think most people out there remember Vince Carter, at least I do, if you think of him as kind of being at his apex as a Toronto Raptor. Is that fair? I think for most of you, that would be where you remember him. I know he also had a decent little stretch with the Nets as well. You think about a lot of his iconic dunks over the years. He won the slam dunk contest back in 2000, really different and incredible career that Vince Carter had, playing all the way until he was 43 years old. How will you remember, and a lot of you remember, I would say, is it Frederick Weiss? Is that the guy's name that he dunked over from France in the Olympics? One of the all-time most iconic dunks, 7-foot-something French big man. I think I'm correct in that. Frederick Weiss, I believe that's his name, the dunk in the Olympics. What will you remember most from Vince Carter's career, Jason Martin?
Just how hyped it was after you saw what he was capable of doing as a dunker. And then just how he seemed to be comfortable in his own skin. Just, look, I'm not going to be Michael Jordan, but I'm going to be okay. And he lasted so much longer than I think you would think, because there were times when it didn't even feel like he cared that much about basketball. Like, it was so natural to him early in his career that he got caught up in the half man, half amazing thing, and he won the dunk contest, greatest dunk contest to me, performance-wise, the greatest dunk contest performance I've ever seen. It just still blows me away. But when he comes out, he's fifth out of North Carolina, fifth pick out of UNC. His numbers are good, and people are talking about him as one of the greatest players of all time. And that's not what ended up happening. But he ended up playing for over two decades in the league. He won the Rookie of the Year in 1999. He played for a lot of different teams, but yeah, you're right. Obviously, I think the Raptors is what most people are going to remember. Then probably the Nets, but I can already throw in Magic, Suns, Mavericks, Grizzlies, Kings, Hawks. I actually think a lot about Vince Carter the same way I do about Grant Hill. Just two guys that you really thought were going to be super special. Now, Grant Hill dealt with some serious injuries. You can also look at somebody like Penny Hardaway, who I don't think he ever ended up being what he could have been because of injuries as well.
Right.
Carter, not necessarily in the same vein, although, I mean, he was banged up from time to time, but just an ultimate competitor that just played because he wanted to keep playing. And look, he was still good. Like, he was still good enough to contribute on the floor. And he never made it just about basketball. That's what you're talking about with maybe what he's doing in the media. He's doing podcasts. He's going to have options, just like you mentioned. But when you look at what he's done, he's third on the all-time list with 1,541 regular season games played. 19th, as you mentioned, on the scoring list. He's a strong Hall of Fame candidate. He in Toronto, he was averaging 23-5-4. And then with the Nets, he was averaging 24-5-5. Never played in the NBA Finals in over two decades. Never made it to the Finals. And I think that's always going to be the one thing you look at and say, he's somebody you thought was going to be good enough to carry a team there. And it never necessarily happened for him like that. But Vince Carter's just... I'm... I'm happy to have gotten to watch his career. And I thought maybe he was just going to fade off into the sunset, not this year, but long ago. But no, he was still productive. He made his last bucket. He made a three in an overtime game for the Hawks against the Knicks in a game that basically turned out to be it because the league got shut down because of COVID-19. He didn't know at the time, but I remember as soon as they shut the league down, that weekend I went on Fox Sports Radio and I said, that might be our last experience watching Vince Carter, because at his age, with everything else, this might be the time to shut it down. And then, of course, yesterday he said, I'm officially done playing. I'm retired.
This is an interesting question, I think, that comes out of Vince Carter being out, and it is this. What do we think about his stat? Is he the greatest dunker in the history of the NBA?
I mean, I think he's the most spectacular.
I think you can make an argument, and let me also add in this caveat. I'm talking about guys who were actually good players, right? Because I think you have to add, like, there are guys who, are almost like and-one mixtapes,
yes,
right? Back in the day, where they are renowned for their leaping ability and their dunking ability, but they were never necessarily the greatest player in the league, right? Or an all-star caliber player where you were like, oh, this guy can really be something special. And I'm trying to think, like, Sean Merriman was a good player, but early in his career, his dunks were just, like, at times breathtaking, right? I mean, his athleticism was off the charts.
Cedric Ceballos, probably another good example.
That's a good example. There are lots of guys who win the NBA All-Star Dunk Contest that aren't ever going to be All-Stars themselves, right? I think you can make an argument that Vince Carter is up there. I'm going to just give you five names, and you tell me whether you agree that they are, without question, top 10 dunkers who are also all-star caliber players, all right? I'm running through right now. I haven't even written this list down. I think I can just do it off the top of my head. Here are five that I feel confident almost everybody out there will have in their list, all right? I just said Vince Carter. I think most people would say for an all-star caliber player, Vince Carter is one of the best dunkers of his generation. And by the way, I'm talking about, like, people that I've actually watched play.
Right.
So I'm not going to go all the way back. Like, I'm sure Wilt Chamberlain had some incredible dunks back in the day. But these are guys that, to me, immediately stand out. And I think, man, that was an iconic dunker who's also an all-star caliber player. In other words, well-rounded, not just an athlete, but also an all-star basketball player. Michael Jordan. I think Michael Jordan, on anybody's list of the top 10 best all-stars in the last, 35 or 40 years, I think you would have to put Michael Jordan on that list of the best dunkers. This one, I think, also is from the same era, and I think you'd have to give him credit for it because they had some really interesting head-to-head battles. I think you'd have to put Dominique Wilkins on that list. And Dominique Wilkins was a great basketball player, but also an incredible dunker. And if you're a young guy out there and you're listening right now, I think watching the slam dunk contest back in the day with Spud Webb and Dominique Wilkins and Michael Jordan, I think that's something that you would really enjoy doing, and it would be worthwhile in your time to go and spend some time there. So I feel good about all three of those guys. This one may be a little bit outside of the expected realm, but I think Blake Griffin. Now, he's a little bit big, right? And that's always a challenge. Big men don't get as much credit for being outstandingly athletic as they do. But Blake Griffin is an all-star caliber player. And over the years, Lob City and beyond, what he was able to do from a dunking perspective is pretty phenomenal, to consider in terms of, again, all-stars who were incredible dunkers. Vince Carter, Michael Jordan, Dominique Wilkins, Blake Griffin. Let's see who I want to put in my five spot as a guy that I feel like, man, this was a all-star caliber player. And this one may be, I'm going to count him as an all-star, but a lot of people are going to remember him from the years when he was super fat. Sean Kemp. Sean Kemp was one of the most electric dunkers that has ever existed in the history of the NBA. How many times did Sean Kemp make the All-Star game? I feel like he made the All-Star game a lot of years. So I think he counts as a electric dunker that was incredible, also All-Star caliber player during his career. So my five, basically over the last, let's say, 30 years or so, Vince Carter, Michael Jordan, Dominique Wilkins, Blake Griffin, Sean Kemp. What do you think of my list, J-Mart? Who would you add?
I would take a few off, but I understand that. I thought about Blake Griffin, and it's not because he's not an all-star caliber player. I think he's a good dunker. This is the way I go. I have Vince at the top of the list. I've got Dominique. And the one thing about Vince, Dominique, MJ, and another guy that I'm going to mention is I think they fully understood how to be, like, out-of-your-mind dunk contest performers on top of being all-star level players. Yeah. I have LeBron written down because he's a great in-game dunker. I don't think he's particularly creative, but he's breathtaking in-game as a dunker. There's a different classifier here.
Yeah, LeBron is an interesting one because he never actually competed in the slam dunk contest.
Because he's not a dunk contest guy. That's what I'm saying. Right. I don't think he has that gene in him. I think he knew that. He might have won because of his name because, well, you know how the voting goes with the guys that are out there and everything. The other two guys that I mentioned you didn't know, or the other two guys that I have written down, one of them I've only really gotten to see a lot of highlights of, but Dr. J. And what he was able to do with the Rock the Cradle and the fact that he's one of the greatest players of all time.
Yeah, that's a good one. I took him out of my equation, so I should clear that up, because I never remember watching Dr. J play. So when I'm saying, like, these are guys that in my life as an NBA basketball fan, I remember watching playing. Dr. J was just a little bit before my time, but he's one that certainly, I think you're right, in terms of the way that he was iconic moving with the basketball and dunking. I think that's a strong argument as well.
And then the other one that I'm going to mention is Dwight Howard. Dwight Howard, who won dunk contests at a height that it's hard to, you talked about how difficult it is at size to do it, just could jump out of the gym. Had every God-given gift that you could possibly have. Now, was he able to maximize that on the floor? He's an all-star level player that carried an Orlando team to the NBA Finals that lost to Kobe Bryant and the LA Lakers. But Dwight Howard was, you know, a top two pick in the draft that looked like he was going to be everything. His career has certainly taken a bad path in recent years. But Dwight Howard, to me, I would put in over Blake Griffin.
By the way, I wanted to look up Sean Kemp because I felt good about this.
I think he was a six-time All-Star, right?
Six-time NBA All-Star. So I think he would classify in terms of being one of my guys. Now, look, I said five of the top ten. So you added several more. I'm sure Twitter wants to react as well, at Clay Travis. And we'll hit some of those that we may have left out, because I'm sure that we did when we come back. Iconic dunkers. Who is the best dunker that has ever existed in your mind? And again, that you've watched play. So, and I understand, I'm 41, Dr. J, just a little bit before my time. So I don't doubt at all that if you're 50, you're like, oh, Dr. J's got to be on the list. But if you're 40, and by the way, if you're 30, you might be like, I never really saw Michael Jordan play very much. I'm not sure Michael Jordan's on this list. And you might not remember Dominique Wilkins very well at all. But I would say those are the five that I have seen that are all-star caliber players that have performed at an incredibly high level. Vince Carter, Hall of Famer? Without question, just based on longevity?
I would be fine if he gets in. I could make an argument either way. But I'll say yeah.
I think he gets in based on his longevity. Obviously, he never got to the – what was the – I know you said this earlier.
Never made the finals.
Yeah, what I remember about that Toronto Raptors era is, didn't he travel to do graduation at UNC before Game 7 at some point in his career?
I believe so. I mean, again, remember that was one of my things that I was saying. It's just like there were times when I didn't feel like basketball was all for him, which I appreciate. I mean, he had a lot of things going on. That's why he's going to be successful going forward in life, because I don't think he ever put all his eggs in one basket. If you want to go back to your bubble discussion, that's like the bubble. You're putting all your eggs in one basket and hope that bubble doesn't get punctured in the NBA side. Vince Carter didn't put all of his eggs in that one basket, and that may have kept him from like elite status, but he was so good for so long, and he was a great ambassador. And from what I can remember, he's just kind of an affable guy in general. Wasn't hard to get along with at all.
Right. Yeah, I think he's a great teammate. I think he will make the All-Star list. I mean, you play as long as he did, and you are a member of so many different iconic moments like Vince Carter was in terms of being an NBA fan, I think he'll definitely get in.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
Chris Mannix joins us now at SI. Chris Mannix, you can find him there, covers the NBA, our NBA insider. Chris, baseball announced their plan to come back. They're basically, it appears, using the home stadiums, and their players will have a relatively normal life. They won't be quarantined, in other words. The NBA sticking with the quarantine bubble in Orlando. Pretty divergent opinions from the Major League Baseball perspective and the NBA perspective. Which one's going to look better?
I mean, if I had to argue any position, it would be that the NBA looks better, if for no other reason than they are creating a sanitized quarantine environment, whereas baseball, you're just going to be on the move. You're going to be traveling on planes and buses and in hotels, presumably, and that just increases your risk of contracting coronavirus. Now, I'm not convinced, Clay, that any of it's going to really work. I think that both sports have the potential to be significantly disrupted by positive tests that could make their respective seasons and postseasons look kind of goofy. But at least basketball is trying to create a environment that will get them through this without a rash of positive tests. I have very little confidence that baseball is going to do it.
All right, so one of the big discussion points, and I'm sure you saw the PGA talking and you've seen the direction that we are moving in general, where LSU, Clemson, Kansas State, every time somebody tests positive, it's a big news story. We know you saw the Sacramento Kings stories. There's been a lot of different NBA players that have tested positive. Let's start with this question. Do you know whether or not the NBA players are going to not only be tested for the coronavirus, but also antibody tested when they arrive in Orlando?
Yeah, I believe both. And my understanding is that testing will be a daily thing down there. I don't know exactly what kind of tests they'll be doing. Specifically, is it the throat culture that they take, the shallow nasal swab, or the incredibly invasive deep nasal swab? But my understanding is that they'll be tested daily. And the antibody test, a lot of players have already had it, and and a lot, I'm sure, will do it afterwards. But I think that's something that will be, at least in the beginning, will be taken, and then they'll go from there.
So the antibody test, and this is, I'm kind of laughing to myself because you and I never would have anticipated, if you had told us last year that you were going to be coming on, like, and you're basically going to have to turn into a virologist or an epidemiologist in order to talk about sports. So, like, just hearing you talk about the deep nasal swab versus the normal nasal swab, I mean, like, it's kind of a weird, like, if we just were able to parachute into, you know, June, and I'd been like, hey, I'm going to interview Chris Mannix about the NBA, and we had been able to listen to this a year ago, we'd be like, what in the world has happened? But, so, I had the deep nasal swab done, because I was like curious for this reason, because so many athletes and coaches are going to be tested. I tested negative, but I wanted to go through the process and see what it was actually like so I could at least experience it. But you talked about this antibody issue, and we've talked about this a lot. We don't know exactly when the first person with the coronavirus was in the United States, but we can at least know it was in January, February, and March. And we know that these guys were playing games in front of crowds in January, February, and March, a lot of times on the coast where this thing was growing pretty substantially. It stands to reason that a lot of NBA players probably already had this, never knew they had it at all, right? Don't you think that's probably likely?
Oh, I think that's almost a guarantee. I mean, and I only base that on the number of players that I've talked to that have had it and didn't know they had it. I mean, you can go all the way back to Donovan Mitchell with the Jazz, who was literally on the floor at Oklahoma City getting ready to play 35 minutes, and he tested positive the next day. Like, this is there's no question that there are a number of players that had it and didn't know that they had it and played right through it. I mean, even now, like, Clay, you're seeing some of the names come out because guys are releasing their own information personally, but I know for a fact that there are a high number of other players that have also tested positive that just aren't having their names out there because they don't want it out there just yet. So you've got, I mean, you have got guys, a lot of guys that were, in the last couple of days since the NBA started its testing protocols, have been very surprised that they tested positive.
So in some ways, this is a positive, right? Because when a guy tests positive, and or test positive for antibodies, in theory, based on all the evidence out there, it seems unlikely that he's at least going to be able to catch it again in the near term, right? And the more people on a team who have had it, the less it would spread in the event someone actually catches it, right? So while a lot of people are reacting like, oh my God, look at all these positive tests, in some ways, whether it's college football, NFL, you know, Ezekiel Elliott, NBA players, until the season actually starts, in many ways, it's actually positive to have guys who are testing positive because that eliminates them as a risk factor, in theory, once the season begins.
Yeah, in some ways it's like a herd immunity, right? Like you can have a bunch of guys that have tested positive that it just creates a better environment. But, I mean, see, here's the biggest question I have over the next couple of weeks. Like, there's going to be positive tests inside the bubble. Like, I mean, covering boxing, I have seen what Nevada and Top Rank have been going through over the last few weeks where they have a very tight bubble, but they are still having fights being scrapped because of positive tests. It just keeps happening. My question I have about the NBA is how many positive tests or how many teams have to be deeply impacted before they kind of, I don't know if scrub the whole thing is the right phrase, but you know, decide it's not for a real championship. That's the biggest question I have, because you're going to have, I mean, there's no question you're going to have three or four players on one team in the playoffs test positive. I think that's a foregone conclusion that it's going to have. And will the NBA continue with this this desire to crown a legitimate champion? They really haven't spelled that out just yet. I mean, I read every page of the 113-page memo, and that's one of the things that still is a little bit ambiguous. Like, how many positive tests has to happen before the NBA decides this isn't how we're going to finish the season?
It's a great question. I think it's the most important question, because the first version of that question was, if you're going to shut everything down like happened with Rudy Gobert as soon as there's a positive case and you're going to quarantine everybody, you can't come back at all, because that is 100% going to happen, right? And and now the PGA is kind of grappling with that. How many tests does it take to be positive where you're just like, yeah, this was an experiment that didn't work? Do you have any sense for that? Like, how tough is Adam Silver going to be? Because that drumbeat of negativity that exists on social media every time somebody tests positive, it's like the first comment is, go ahead and stop it all, right? But there's a lot of money at stake here. The NBA has spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to do this. How resilient do you get the sense that Adam Silver is going to be to the negative drumbeat of positive tests?
Very resilient. And I don't know if there's a benchmark that the NBA has for number of tests where they just say, you know, this is ridiculous. But, you know, one thing I've said and written and talked to you about is that the NBA badly wants to protect the postseason. Like, they want to crown a legitimate champion one way or the other. If it's not wholly legitimate, they'll find a way to crown a champion no matter what. Like, they want to do to go through these playoffs and finish the season with an NBA Finals, with a champion, and fulfill those TV obligations that they have to ESPN, Turner, and even the regional networks that are going to get their piece of the pie in the end of the regular season and the first round of the playoffs. So I think they're going to be incredibly resilient. I think there's a very good chance, Clay, that this, from the outside world, it starts to look really goofy, but the NBA just keeps plowing forward because they want to finish the year.
A couple of people who have made interesting decisions. What is the NBA response you have heard to, I believe it's Davis Gortak, making the decision not to come back, or sorry, Davis Bertans. All these names run together. Davis Bertans, I believe, right? Making the decision not to come back for the Washington Wizards. What is the NBA reaction? I've seen some of his teammates kind of not necessarily take it well. I got to be honest with you. If I was in his position and I was about to be a free agent and make a lot of money and I had double ACL injuries like he had, there's no way I would play when I don't believe my team has a chance to win a championship.
No, the NBA doesn't love Bertans' decision there. Like, they can understand Avery Bradley, certainly. He's got a son that is dealing with a respiratory illness. They can understand Trevor Ariza. I mean, that's a deeply personal situation with his ex, and he's got to deal with that. The Bertans stuff is more of a, you know, precautionary measure that I agree with you. Bertans is well within his rights and should do something like that. He is in line for potentially a $12 to $15 million per year contract. You don't screw with that. You don't mess with that for playing eight games in a meaningless regular season where the maybe the only outcome that you know could happen would be you suffering some kind of injury that would be consequential. Why the NBA hates it, though, is that there's a trickle-down effect from it. If Bertans doesn't play, there's no question Bradley Beal's probably looking around going, well, why am I going to play? Like, I have no upside here. I'm going to come back and play with John Wall next year, and Bertans will be back next year, and let's just gear up for that season. I actually texted before I spoke to you in the Wizards organization. We were kind of joking, like, are you going to suit up George Mirosan for, like, 15 minutes a game at this point? Because I think there's going to be several of their high-profile players that or play like three games and bow out or don't play at all. So Bertans was kind of the first domino, and I think there'll be a lot of subsequent dominoes with a team like the Wizards moving forward. But keep an eye, Clay, in the coming days. Like, I've long said that, you know, the young players that we've talked about, the Jason Tatums, the Donovan Mitchells, the guys in line for max contracts, they're not the ones you have to watch for bowing out of these things. It's the Bertans types. And there are a bunch of guys like that. It's, you know, Marcus Morris with the Clippers, Paul Millsap with the Denver Nuggets, Danilo Gallinari with the Thunder. These are guys in their early to mid-30s that are looking at maybe the last contract of their professional careers. And how comfortable are they going to be going out there after having virtually, I don't want to say virtually no warm-up, but a very limited warm-up, and potentially risking injury? I mean, Bertans was the exact type of player I anticipated bowing out, and I don't think he'll be the last.
You talked to a ton of people in the NBA, and you came on, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, to talk about how you saw this thing breaking out in terms of who's advantaged, who's disadvantaged, because it's basically a tournament more than it's a continuation of the existing season. What are you hearing from executives as they assess how this thing is going to play out and which teams they think stand to gain the most by the way this situation is set up?
Honestly, they have no idea. Like, the executives I talk to, I put it this way, I've yet to hear an executive from a playoff team say, oh, we're screwed. Like, I had my best player come back, you know, 20 pounds heavier, out of shape. They're not seeing that yet. But again, as we speak, there's still guys just kind of trickling in. They're doing one-on-one workouts and, you know, just starting to get in with assistant coaches. We haven't seen five-on-fives yet, and that really is the first benchmark or measuring stick that teams are going to look for to see where they currently stand. So everything else, you know, at this point is complete conjecture, speculation, you know, looking at numbers. These guys need to see what their players look like when they go through five-on-five scrimmages, see who's in shape, see who's sharp, and you know, again, frankly, see who's actually there and ready to participate.
Okay, so you yourself, I think, told us a couple of teams, like, if you were going to take a flyer on the gambling situation, because you got a lot of teams that everybody's focused on, the Lakers, the Clippers, the Bucks. But what is really kind of interesting is looking at some of these lower-tier teams that could theoretically make a run. Who do you like outside of the traditional powers that you look now at the way the NBA is set up and you say, boy, this team could make a run? I'll give you the update, by the way. I'm looking at Fox Bet. Milwaukee Bucks, Lakers, both plus 250. Clippers are 3-1. And then there's a lot of teams that are all double-digit underdogs. Who stands out to you?
You know, I brought this up on your show a few weeks back and actually wrote about it a little bit later on after we talked. I mean, the Sixers, to me, are a smart bet. And I called Brett Brown, the Sixers coach, and kind of ran my theory by him. Like, you know, you guys suck at shooting threes. You know, everybody's going to suck at shooting threes. You got Ben Simmons back. Joel Embiid claims he's working out 6 days a week. Who knows how true that is. But, you know, there's some merit, I think, to the argument that Philadelphia is the team most equipped to win those down and dirty, grimy 90-85 type of slugfest. I mean, they're not a prolific scoring team. They're not a prolific three-point shooting team. Simmons, who was done for the season in mid-March, is going to play and probably give them 30-35 minutes a night. I mean, they are almost built for a pandemic playoff. They really are. And, you know, I think there's a lot of variables, not the least of which is you got to kind of like each other, and I'm not sure the Sixers do. You know, down in Orlando, you got to be around your teammates a lot. But on paper, Philadelphia, to me, is one of the best long-shot bets you can possibly make at this point.
And what is it in particular about Philadelphia? I mean, they've obviously had a lot of internal tension with the team getting along and everything else. But right now, you could get the Sixers at 20-1.
I'd do it. I mean, look, their ability to defend at three positions at an elite level is the first one. I mean, Simmons, you've got Embiid, you've got Josh Richardson, you've got guys that can lock you down individually. And they also have a guy that, at least on paper, should be able to give you high percentage shots in Joel Embiid. So while everybody else, like Houston, Milwaukee, is shooting like low 30s from three, and giving the Sixers, a great transition team, opportunities to get up and down, in the half court, if you're Philadelphia, you can just dump it into Embiid and try to win like the old Jordan Bulls won or the old Hakeem Olajuwon Rockets won, play through the post and succeed that way. So I just, again, I need to see what they look like when they come back and exactly where Simmons is at with this back injury, but they just make too much sense as one of those long shot bets to kind of put something together and make a run.
Is this more, does this matter more for LeBron the way this season ends than almost anybody else in the league? Because you've got the Warriors that are going to surge back into contention in the West. You've got the Nets, which theoretically, when Kevin Durant comes back, assuming he's healthy, and Kyrie, they're going to be a lot better. The overall depth and talent across the league is going to surge whenever they come back for another season. The Lakers have a lot of older pieces, in theory. Is this LeBron's last best chance to win an additional championship as the focal point? I know he could hang on for a while as a guy who's a role player, but as the driving force for a team, is this it?
Yeah, you can make that argument for two reasons. One is what you said, that the league around him is going to get better next year. I mean, the Warriors, I think, are at least a candidate to trade that top pick and get a veteran player to add to that mix to fit into their timeline with guys in their early 30s. And the Nets, I think, are going to be great with Durant and Kyrie back next year. And look, we look at LeBron as indefatigable, and it's fair because he's never shown any significant drop-off in his game. But at some point, you know, in December, he's going to be 36 years old. You've got to anticipate, you know, there's going to be a slippage there. And Anthony Davis, as great as he's played this year, he's been fragile in his career. He's been banged up. So, you know, you can certainly make the case that Davis might get hurt, might deal with some kind of injuries that would derail the Lakers next season. I mean, this is the Lakers, I think, best chance during the LeBron era to win a championship. I mean, circumstances can certainly change. They might trade or acquire somebody else. But right now, as you look at the landscape, this is the year the Lakers need to win.
Avery Bradley steps out. Let's go into the Laker matchup against the Clippers, which I think most people anticipate is going to happen at some point. I would make the argument that the Clippers are now the better team top to bottom. I'm betting you probably would agree. And also that the Clippers would be advantaged by not having crowds present because they were going to be the underdog in all seven games in terms of crowds if they were playing in the Staples Center. Would you agree with both of those premises? And would you agree that maybe the Clippers have what it takes to get past the Lakers? How would you assess that matchup in the event it happens?
Yeah, I would. I mean, you know, a seven-game series at Staples is all going to be purple and gold there, no matter who's got home court. So that's certainly part of it. I think the Clippers, the time off probably benefits them. I mean, Kawhi, we know his knee issues. Paul George and battling different injuries. I mean, at least as far as what we know, it definitely benefits them more than it benefits the Lakers. And the Bradley loss is huge. I mean, this is a guy that was playing 25 minutes a game. I mean, he was a integral part of their backcourt rotation. His last game, or one of his last games, I forget if it was the last one, but it was against the Clippers, and he scored 24 points. And he was having his best month to date in the month of March, averaging like 10 points per game, playing close to 30 minutes. I mean, you have some depth there in L.A. Alex Caruso has been really good alongside LeBron. The numbers back that up. God knows if they sign J.R. Smith. I don't know how that's going to go. But, you know, Danny Green is still there. But losing Avery Bradley takes away a ball handler, a three-point shooter, and an on-ball defender. Those guys don't grow on trees. Like, Bradley's loss, I think, could be the kind of loss that tips the balance of power in the Western Conference.
Good stuff, as always. Anything else as we let you go and we roll out into the weekend and into the July 4th holiday? What's next for NBA fans? What should we be paying attention to for those of us who are intrigued and interested in how this is going to play out?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just the protocols moving forward. I mean, we've seen the medical protocols in that report, but, you know, what does the NBA say about a run of positive tests? I don't look, you know, these are young guys, healthy guys, for the most part, there's no significant health risk associated with them. But how far, and we talked about this at the top, but how far will the NBA go if their playoffs start to look goofy? If you get to the conference semifinals and two teams are just decimated by injuries, will the NBA continue on this path and say, this is the real conference semifinals, or will they pivot away and call it something else. That's the one area, Clay, there just really isn't a lot of clarity yet. I know Adam Silver has been talking to the union about it. I think over the next few days, we will get more insight into what the NBA's mindset is on that.
I know I said last question, but you said something that I think is interesting and worth unpacking. It's true that these guys, as young and healthy themselves, and considering that they're not going to be exposed to very many people in the bubble, are not under that much physical danger themselves. To what extent do you think the NBA players know that? In other words, it's very easy if you just put on the news or if you just read headlines or if you sit around on social media to really get lost in fear, right? It's very, very easy. And I think if you're young, that can be easy as well because the data doesn't really get shared. To what extent do you think the average NBA player is well informed about the health risk to them specifically based on their age?
I actually think they're very informed about it, but I would also say that there are a lot of players that have circumstances that mirror Avery Bradley's, whether it's you know, a spouse or a girlfriend that has some kind of immune issue or a child that's dealing with something. And these guys are going to effectively jump in mid-July, and you know, several of them that I've talked to or people around them say that they're legitimately tormented by it. Like, they don't know what to do. Like, they want to be around their kids. You know, the NBA is big on that, like having their kids come out there and shoot around with them. Like, a lot of NBA players do that. They want to be around them, but they're still processing the information about how dangerous it is for loved ones. I don't think, and I have yet to talk to a player or a representative of a player that says, like, my guy's scared of contracting and what it might mean for them. It's always about what it means for people around them, which I think is certainly a legitimate concern if you've got family members effectively becoming your roommates for several months down in Orlando.
No doubt. Chris Mannix, always great. SI Chris Mannix, follow him there. Appreciate the time, my man. Have a good weekend.
You got it, Clay.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
We haven't talked a lot. We did in that discussion a little bit with Chris Mannix about Avery Bradley and his decision not to play. You guys know that I believe sports needs to return and that it's important for our country to get back to a sense of normalcy by having sports return. But let me just be clear here as well. Every individual athlete or coach should have the right about whether they want to play without having to worry about what other people think, right? The great thing about America, I believe that you are going to be safe, especially if you are a young and healthy athlete. But everybody's got different family situations. Everybody's got different unique lifestyle concerns. I'm not walking in every single person's shoes. So if a guy like Avery Bradley, because of his family situation, does not feel comfortable going down to Orlando and playing in that bubble for the remainder of the NBA season, more power to him for not going. I don't begrudge anybody, and I would say this the same thing, college football players, NFL, college basketball, NBA, NHL, Major League Baseball, everybody should be able to make the decision not to work. That's fundamental to our rights as Americans, and if you don't believe it makes sense on an individual basis because of family concerns or maybe just personal considerations of your own to come back to work, you shouldn't do it. We shouldn't have to bully anybody to being able to come back. Now, I think there are lots of people out there that would be happy to work. For instance, if some Major League Baseball players are like, I'm not going to get paid enough money, I think there are a ton of minor league baseball players that would love the opportunity to come and play in a 60-game season, even in the middle of a pandemic. And so, if they make the decision, a Major League Baseball player doesn't want to play, or an NBA player doesn't want to play, or somebody in the NFL doesn't want to play, that's 100% their right. It should be a next man up scenario, just like it is whenever you have an injury. And I have to say, that's what I think the vast majority of you out there thinking and listening to me would agree with as well. Like, I don't think this is remotely controversial. Even if it's a great player, right? Even if it's a great player, even if Kawhi Leonard, which I don't think is going to happen, obviously, but even if somebody like Kawhi said, you know what, I don't feel comfortable coming back and playing, you're not going to get paid, right? That's got to be the scenario as well. But if you decide not to come back and play, that's your right. And I think you should have the decision and may be able to make that decision like anybody else. And we should respect it. And so whether it's Avery Bradley, it's a little bit different with Davis Bertans, right? Because he's got more to worry about in terms of he's a free agent and he doesn't want to injure himself. But I've said this for a long time. If you told me, and I've used it to talk about college football players, if you told me, hey, Clay Travis, tomorrow your voice might stop working on the radio, but if you sit out for a month, you'll never have any concerns with your voice for the rest of your career, I'd probably sit out for a month. If you told me there was a decent chance that I could have major voice issues for the rest of my life, why would I risk it? I'm going to make a lot of money talking. Why would I risk my voice, which is how I make my livelihood? If you're an NBA player and you're set to make a ton of money as a free agent and your team has no chance to win a championship, why in the world would you come back? So I kind of agree with both of those decisions that have been made in the context of the NBA return. I understand sitting out instead of coming back and playing eight games for the Washington Wizards that really don't matter very much. And I certainly understand sitting out for health-related reasons because you're concerned about your family situation. Doesn't mean necessarily that I would make the same decision, but again, everybody has unique circumstances that are different than what you or I might be going through. And so that decision to me can make an awful lot of sense, and I don't think anybody should be criticized for making it. I think every pro athlete and every college athlete should have the right to make that decision on their own without feeling the peer pressure of having to go just because other people are going. Now, I have said a lot, and you guys know if you listen to the show, young and healthy people have very little risk, so I would go. If I were an NBA player or I was a Major League Baseball player, I would play this year. NFL player, same thing. If I were an athlete, if I were a tennis player, golfer, whatever else, I would be doing it. That's my personal decision, but I wouldn't judge anybody else who makes a choice not to do that.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
We are joined now with Bobby Barak. And Bobby, this story, we were just talking about, Jason Martin and I, about the alleged noose that was found in Bubba Wallace's garage, which ended up being a pull door. NASCAR's released a photo of it. NASCAR says now we should have said an alleged noose, which certainly would have maybe changed the way the story was covered. Because the intent of that pull rope can matter. And I am not an expert in how you tie ropes, but I do know for anybody out there who has been in the Boy Scouts, they teach you, because my kids were in the Boy Scouts, they teach you how to do a variety of knot ties. And people, you know, can fashion many different ways to create a loop handle so that you could be able to pull down a garage door. So first question for you, you write it out, Kick. You can follow Bobby on Twitter. You are 22 years old, I think. Do you ever remember in your life being in a garage where you had to pull a garage down with a rope involved?
No, but I've seen a lot of movies where you've had to. So I wasn't surprised when I found that to be the case. So, no, I have that personally, but I know that that's how it used to be.
That's how it used to be.
Yeah.
So maybe back in the old days.
Time there, but yeah, so to know, I have not. But maybe one day
hold on.
To.
J-Mart, I didn't ask you in the last segment, have you ever had to, and by the way, I should mention, we were going to talk with Barrett Salee. Barrett was not able to join us, so I've called in Bobby Barak and Ryan Glasspiegel to finish out the week with me. But have you ever, I'm sure, J-Mart, you're around my age, I'm sure you have been in a garage where you had to pull it down with a rope.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think about garages, I think about attics. Sometimes as well. Ropes do exist to pull down doors. Like these are things that happen. There was actually a time when ropes were used in Boy Scouts, like you mentioned. I mean, I learned to tie knots so I could get some merit badges before I realized I didn't want to be a Boy Scout, so I decided to move on from it. But yeah, I absolutely remember the old school garage pulls.
All right. So, Bobby, how would you, if you were giving the media a letter grade? So you write about the media a lot at Outkick. If you were giving the sports media a letter grade for their coverage of the NASCAR alleged noose incident, what letter grade would you give us?
I would go low, B-, because not only were they irresponsible Monday and Tuesday morning by not asking questions, jumping to conclusions, really pushing things further than they should have been, plus what was out there, but yesterday, the first step was admitting you were wrong, and very few media members even admitted they were wrong. They were making excuses why they came down so hard. I saw a lot of people say, well, I'm still glad this came out because we all came together and came down on NASCAR, who deserved this. I mean, what? That doesn't make any sense to me. If you're someone on Monday, and there was a lot, including, I think, Jamel Hill probably at the forefront, really crushed NASCAR, crushed their fans, crushed everybody, calling for major changes, to not come back Tuesday afternoon when it was found by the FBI that it was not a noose, it was a rope that's been there for a while, it was not a heinous act, to not even admit you were wrong, to say, okay, I messed up, to me, that's where you get a failing grade. So maybe if their coverage was like a C- on Monday, their irresponsibility of not changing their perspective on Tuesday and defending themselves the past 2 days, that's where I bring it down to a low grade. If we go by college standards, a D and D minus is failing. That's right where the media is right now.
So NASCAR says they've looked into this. They said they should have said it was an alleged noose. They put out the picture, everything else. Is this story over, or do you think it will continue to echo for Bubba Wallace, for NASCAR, or come Monday, is this basically done, right? Like, we're talking about it on Friday because it's dominated the entire week's news cycle. Everybody's got an opinion now. The picture's out there. Everybody had an opinion when the FBI investigated it and everything else. How would you assess this story? Like, what kind of legs, if any, does it have?
Well, I mean, last night it was a big thing about media people fighting about it. To Will Cain's credit, he brought on several of his colleagues that disagree with his take, and that really became a discussion in and of itself. Who's right with the people that said the media got it wrong, or the people that are standing by their takes? I'd imagine the story isn't dead yet. It doesn't have a lot of legs now just because we did find out that it really wasn't anything at all, which is a good thing. So I don't think it's going to be a major story. But as you know, Clay, there's not a lot of sports going on right now. Really none. I mean, not from a national level. What we talk about is a couple of some golf going on here and there, but not national topics. So if there is something to talk about, I think we're going to continue to. Now, it just takes one person in the media to say something absurd to get everybody talking about their take. So I would not be shocked if on Monday we're still talking about the story, but maybe it's the third or fourth topic, not number one like it's been all week.
All right, so other news that is out there, you, along with other people at OutKick, have been writing about what they're going to do to replace this show's competition. Which is right now, I believe, Mike Golic and Trey Wingo. Both of those guys are now out. You guys have reported it's going to be Keyshawn Johnson and Max Kellerman. The New York Post reported yesterday that Keyshawn Johnson is in. Who do you think ESPN is going to end up with? Do you still think it's going to be Keyshawn Johnson and Max Kellerman?
So we reported 2 weeks ago that ESPN was in deep discussion with Keyshawn for morning radio, and the first choice for his co-host was Max Kellerman. I've said throughout the week here that talks with Keyshawn have advanced, and I'm told as well that those are done now. He is locked in for morning radio. Kellerman is a really complicated situation. While there are people at ESPN that still want him to do that show, I think Keyshawn wants him to do that. He still does do First Take, and he has no interest of leaving First Take. So it's going to be really hard to do morning radio 6 to 10 or 6 to 9, and then go right to First Take. There's some doubt now that that deal with Kellerman is going to get done. So that appears less likely, though there are still people that want to get that done. But yes, Keyshawn is locked in for morning radio, so that is one spot filled. They still have several other shows that they're trying to work out. We reported earlier this week, Mike Greenberg, he's real close to getting his deal locked in for some show in the afternoon, whether it's 1 to 3 or 12 to 2, somewhere in that range. So the ESPN radio picture is starting to clear up, but there's still some questions about how they replace Will Cain, who was last show is today, because that 3 to 6 spot is still wide open. I could see Mike Golic Jr. possibly sliding in there with the co-host, but there's still a lot of moving parts. And as we talked about a couple weeks ago, Clay, there's not a lot of options. There are a few people on that roster right now. They're just waiting that can do radio at a high level. They're likely going to have to develop people and hope that it doesn't go terribly wrong, because there is not somebody waiting right now to say, okay, I can replace Will, or I'm going to enhance morning radio. If it's not Kellerman, I don't see who else is going to be capable of making that show better than what it is currently right now with Trey Wingo and Mike Golic.
Hate to brag or draw attention to myself, but this will be the third change they've made since we started. They had like 20 yeah. years of normalcy. Then Mike and Mike broke up about a year after we started. And then now Mike Golic is out. And so the entire show is going to be different. And obviously we've been growing a lot. That show has not grown. So I'm kind of curious who they'll put in there. Not that it's going to really change very much about what we do. Last question for you, and I appreciate you coming on with us. Do you buy in? You had an article up yesterday, I guess it was Wednesday, on Outkick, or maybe it was Tuesday. I can't even remember. All the days have run together, about George R.R. Martin, potentially, for Game of Thrones fans out there who read the books, about him teasing the sixth volume, I think, right, of his books.
Yeah.
Do you buy in that it's going to be back? By the way, George R.R. Martin, huge New York Jets fan, which I would have never anticipated because I think of him as kind of this British guy based on the way the books have been written, but he's a huge NFL guy.
I'm so happy you have Jason Martin back there in the studio because I spoke to him the morning after Game of Thrones ended last mm-hmm. year, and what he told me stuck in my head. He goes, Bobby, the showrunners, Benioff and Weiss, they couldn't figure out how to end this story. And the guy that created it, he can. I still agree with J. Martin. I don't think George R. R. Martin has any idea how to finish this story. And there's no reason to believe that he's going to have this book finished next year like he said he wants to. He's been saying dates now for a decade. It's been a decade since his last book. He still has another one that's probably going to be even longer in the works, the final one. I don't think we're ever going to get that. So as much as I love that book to come out, I pre-order and have it read as fast as you were able to read it, I just don't see it happening. And part of me, I said this the other day, I don't know if I want it out because if it comes out, it's going to be great. I'm going to be all in, back in the characters, immersed in Westeros. Then I'm going to have to wait probably another decade or 15 years for the final book, which I've already said I don't expect we're ever going to get.
Good stuff. As always, go read Bobby Barak at Outkick, outkick.com.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.